Okay, thanks, Mike. So first slide, thanks. So for those of you who are not familiar to being about being on this safe side of the stage, what normally happens is we get a telephone call or an email, usually many months in advance, asking us to talk at some presentation. And for me, that's part of my job. So if my calendar is free, I automatically agree to that. And then the next thing that happens is you get an email saying, can you provide us your presentation? And it's usually by tomorrow. And at that point, you look back through your emails or you look at the website and you find the topic that you were, that is there next to your name, and you think, what on earth was I thinking about when I agreed to talk about that particular topic? So then there's a couple of options of what you can do. And if you're a geneticist, of course, what you would do is this. You would immediately genotype yourself. And so you'd get some scrapes of DNA, send it off, and check, have I got Alzheimer's? And it turns out that the particular pair of genotypes that I have for Alzheimer's put me at a lower risk of Alzheimer's than normal. So I guess it's nothing to do with my memory. So then you look back at your email and you discover that, in fact, that was exactly the topic that Megan sent me many months ago and asked if I would like to change it, and I guess I just never got around to doing that. So I guess what I would have preferred to have had the topic saying is good news, they're all carriers of something. So you can look at a glass being half full or you can look at a glass being half empty, but I think it's good news. So if there's one thing that you get out of today, I think that should be that having options and having carriers and knowing about mutations, having more information is good news for selection. It's not bad news for selection. So that's a mindset you're going to have to change. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some inherited phenotypic disorders. I'm going to talk a little bit about using SNP genotypes, a little bit about sequence data, and a little bit about managing disorders. So I did what we often do when we have to give these kind of talks. So when you talk about defects and about carriers and about mutants, mutant sounds like a bad word. You have this image of something that's really bad. And when you think of carriers, you're normally thinking of particularly bad-looking things. This happens to be a defect that's being studied at the moment. The gene responsible has not yet been found to my knowledge, but there are animals that have a malformed mouth and nose. So these are the kinds of things that in the past, these things became apparent and information was collected on these, and eventually we ended up discovering the cause and coming up with a test for them. So if you go and Google them, then Google defects, you'll find this lists like this one. This comes from an article Matt Spangler put together, and it shows a list of genetic defects that are monitored by US Beef Cattle Breed Associations. And I would have to say, when I look at that, knowing some of the things I know, I'd have to say that list is a bit appalling. And what's appalling about that list is how small it is. Because I know that there are many, many more defects out there that appear on this list. This is just the ones we know about. So what's appalling is how few we've been able to discover, how few have been identified, and how few you know about. I can guarantee that in 5 or 10 years' time, this list will be very much larger than what you see there. But the thing that appealed to me about that list, one of the things that appealed to me about it, was the first defect that was there, alpha mannosidosis, because it's a disease that I have a little bit of an interest in. And some of you may not know about mannosidosis because of your age, but mannosidosis was first known, and what known means is the first time somebody published about it was in 1957, and at that time it was known in Angus, it's known to be in Murray Grey and Galloway cattle as well. In 1970, about 10% of the Angus animals in New Zealand were carriers. Homozygous recessive individuals develop head tremors, they have difficulty walking, they have aggressive behaviour if they live long enough to demonstrate that, they fail to thrive, most of them die shortly after birth, some of them may abort prior to normal calving, or they die within their first year. and it's caused by a deficiency of an enzyme, a lysosomal enzyme, an enzyme called alpha-mannosidase. And alpha-mannosidase is an enzyme, it's a protein, it's an enzyme that breaks down mannose. And mannose is an oligosaccharide, so it's something like lactose, for instance. And if it doesn't get broken down, it just accumulates, and it accumulates in the lysosome and causes all kinds of problems. And it's now known that there are various SNPs, or single nucleotide polymorphisms, which are changes in the gene that codes for that particular enzyme that causes this particular disease. And the reason this disease interests me is that in 1978, when I moved into the dorms at the university where I went to study for my bachelor's degree, there was a very nice herd of Angus cows right out the window. And that was nice having come from a city environment to be out there with all those Angus cows. But very soon in my lectures I discovered that those Angus cows actually were not normal Angus cows. Those Angus cows were all carriers of mannosidosis, because Bob Jolly, the second author on this paper, and Dick Back were two professors at the university who were studying this disease. And the herd of cows was a herd that they were using for progeny testing bulls to identify bulls that were carriers of this alpha-mannosidase broken enzyme. And what they showed, Dick Back was a biochemist, and what they showed was that if you looked at the concentration of the enzyme in the blood, you got this interesting distribution that had two different means. And this just demonstrates additive gene action. So the peak on the right is the distribution of the enzyme when the animal has two copies of the gene that can make the enzyme. The distribution on the left, which is quite separate, is the distribution of the carriers. So the carriers have two copies of the gene, but one of the copies is broken because of a single nucleotide polymorphism, a change in the amino acid sequence. And as a consequence of that, when you look at the levels of the blood, you can see quite clearly, straight away, the animal that looks perfectly all right but has one broken gene, and the animal that has no broken genes. So in 1972, they developed national testing. It was a requirement for an animal to be registered that it had to be shown that it was not in the distribution on the left. And by 1980, this disease, as far as I know, had been eradicated from New Zealand. And what we know now, today, that's probably not the right thing that should have been done, but it's what they did in that day. It's not what I would recommend if we found another disease like this tomorrow. So I could show you many, many examples of these kind of diseases, but I just want to show you a couple that you may not have heard about. You should know about all the ones that exist here in beef cattle. But this is one that occurred recently, just last year. These are dairy cows that are due to, they're around about their first calving. And what you notice is the one in the middle is a little bit different from the others. It's a little bit hairier. Maybe a little bit smaller, just doesn't look like it's doing quite so well. And it turned out that these were offspring of what I call a widely used young bull. So he wasn't really all that widely used, but he was widely used for a bull that was just a yearling. He was a yearling bull that was very high based on 50K genomic tests. So the bull was used about as widely as he could be based on the constraints of collecting semen when he was just 12 months old. So when he was just past 12 months old, they got 12,000 roughly AI inseminations from him. So some of those inseminations didn't conceive. Some of those cows were culled and a calf never turned up. And he ended up with about 6,000 offspring recorded. About 3,000 of those were daughters, and about 1,500 of them were affected in the manner that I showed you in the photo. So that's about half of them. So this is not a recessive disease. This has got to be a disease due to a dominant mutation. And show you something else about the phenotype. So that's not an Angus animal, that's a Holstein. It's a Holstein animal, hairy, it seeks water and mud. So these animals have a little bit of heat stress. So if there was water around, they got in the water, they lay in the water. So you can see it's hairy, it's got a lot of mud on it, And this is in temperate conditions in New Zealand, so there's something strange about their ability to regulate heat. But what was more disturbing about these animals is that although they got pregnant, they cycled, they got pregnant and they calved, you'll notice they don't have proper mammary gland development. They didn't produce milk. So the cow calved and didn't produce milk. They just produced a waxy kind of a compound. And some of them produced a little bit of milk and were milked for a few days or a few weeks, but many of them produced nothing at all. And it turned out to be caused by what we call a de novo mutation. So a de novo mutation is a new mutation. This means the particular bull that had these affected daughters, he was spreading it, he had a broken gene. But his father didn't have it, and his mother didn't have it. It was a new error that occurred in the meiosis that that produced that particular bull. And it raised some interesting questions about liability, because when a calf is born and there's some problem with it, it's a defect, maybe people don't worry so much about the liability issue. But when they've reared this animal all the way up to 2 years on expectation to start lactating and it doesn't produce milk, many of these farmers wanted compensation from the company that had sold the semen. And the company had actually, as soon as they were aware of the problem, they offered free testing of anybody who had daughters of this particular bull, and they refunded the semen costs. But many of them asked for more information. The mutation is now known and the problem has disappeared. I want to show you another one that you may not have heard about. A condition that was discovered in Europe, but it would have also occurred in this country. It's in Holsteins. It's called Brachyspina, and brachy just means short, so it means short spine. You can see an affected calf on the photo on the right-hand side. You see its spines are a little bit curved. There's vertebral malformation, long slender limbs, inferior brachynatism, so that just means its teeth weren't even, it had strange thing in its mouth, had malformed heart, kidneys and testicles. It occurred less than 1 in 100,000 births. So you imagine a breed association that had 100,000 animals in this country, would you find a defect that had less than 1 in 100,000 birth occurrence? There were 6 samples that were managed to be obtained from this, and it's just remarkable what can be achieved now with some of the genotyping technology. And I'm sorry this slide is a little bit busy, but this is a legal one that you can actually download directly from the website of the publication. If we start with a little graph at the top that has the curve going up of red lines, those red lines are just representing each of the 29 pairs of autosomes in the bovine genome. And then the left axis is telling you about the probability that a particular genomic region causes the disease. And what you see is a whole lot of little blue lines up there sitting on chromosome 21. So just from those 6 affected calves that they got, running the 50K panel over those 6 calves, they were able to show that this defect was on chromosome 21. And then if you look at the next yellow and orange graph, you can see some little black marks. And those black marks, each row is one of the 6 calves that had the defect. The little black marks represents regions that the animal's genome was homozygous in that particular position. And so different of those calves had slightly different homozygous regions. And there's a little red mark below it that shows you the region where every one of the calves was homozygous in that position. So once you know where that position is, you can go onto the web and you can look at a database and find out what genes are in that particular position. And that's what that table is for, all those blue genes. And you can look up the effect of those genes. And one of those genes was a gene called FANC1. And FANC1 was shown previously to cause exactly this condition in humans. So it was like a smoking gun. That was highly likely to have been a cause of this defect. So then they sequenced that particular gene in these 6 animals, and they found, again, the very bottom chart there, you can see a little red mark. There was a piece of the DNA that coded for that gene was missing, 300 and 3,300 bases have been deleted. So that was what that particular in that caused that disease. So these are examples, and there are many more we could look at, what I call phenotype first defects. So it's where a defect turns up on a farm, the farmer reports it, and as a result of that, it's determined to be genetic, and perhaps the cause is discovered. It relies on reports from producers, and we also require collection of DNA samples. Hardly a year goes by when I don't get a call from somebody telling me about a problem. I had a call last year from a rancher in Montana who was telling me that they were vaccinating their calves, and they noticed that while they were vaccinating, a calf very shortly afterwards went into shock and died. And they thought that was a little bit surprising, but over the course of the day it happened to 6 or 7 calves. And I said, well, probably they have a defect that's causing a reaction to the vaccine you were giving them. Did you pull a hair sample? And he said, no. If he just simply pulled hair samples from those 6 calves, we could have done exactly the same thing that had happened with Brachyspheria. We could have developed a test and made sure that that didn't occur on other ranches. So many producers, especially seed stock producers, are reluctant to report such occurrences. Many well-known defects have yet to be characterised because of lack of availability of DNA samples. I had a call one day from a farmer who told me he had a whole lot of lambs that had no eyes. And he wasn't worried about it because the lambs grew quite well, but it looked like it was a genetic defect. I said, have you spoken to the breeder? He said he had, and there was no help there. I called up the breeder and asked the breeder, and yes, some years before, the breeder had had some animals on his property that had no eyes, and he immediately killed the rams and he killed the ewes, and he thought he'd cleanse the pedigree, but that was not the case. If he had provided samples for us at that time, we could have found the defect. Instead, we got the samples from the producer who had bought rams from him, and we found the defect, and now there's a test for that. So that's great, but what about embryonic lethals? What happens if the embryo dies and so you never get to see the dead calf that looks mutant and looks strange? Well, what happens if it's just a normal looking calf but it's dead? You don't take too much notice of it. That happens occasionally, but it could be a defect. Well, what happens to a mutation that slightly reduces performance, so it makes an animal grow a bit slower than it otherwise would have grown? What happens about those? How are we going to find those things? Well, what's interesting about the embryo lethal problem is this Brachyspheria one, and that's why I chose that particular example. Because once they found the defect, they imputed onto the 550K haplotypes of the Dutch Holstein population, and they were horrified to discover that 7% of the Holstein sires in the Netherlands carried this defect. So if 7% of the sires carried it and 7% of the dams carried it, that meant that 1 in 200 of the matings would have between a carrier sire and a carrier dam. And in those particular matings, 1 in 4 of the offspring should have had the effect. So 1 in 800 matings, roughly, should have produced this condition, which was only seen in less than 1 in 100,000. So they guessed that maybe it was due to embryo lethality. So what they did is they went to the database in the Netherlands and they looked at all of the mating records. And if we look at the grey boxes on the left showing a little pedigree, the sire, the grey boxes with the pluses means the sire was clean. He did not carry the mutation. And he was mated to dams who had not been genotyped. But if those dams were born to a sire that was clean, and they could go back further on the pedigree, they could determine that those matings were unlikely to have had the defect. They set the failure rate for those inseminations of those kind of pairs to zero. And they compared that to the 3 kind of matings that I show you in the boxes to the right. The first one is where the maternal grandsire, so the cow's father, was known to be a carrier. The second one is where the sire that was mated to the cow was known to be a carrier. So neither of those matings would be expected to produce a homozygous offspring. And then on the far right, the ones that I've got in an orange box represent the cases where the sire was known to be a carrier, and the cow's father was known to be a carrier. So those were kind of like, they would have been carrier mating. At least half of the daughters of that bull would have been carriers. And what you see, the blue lines represent the failure rate based on pregnancy tests at different stages of gestation. And what you can see is that there's a relative to these cows mated to bulls that are not carriers, there's a gradual increase in the failure rate as pregnancy proceeds. So what's happening is these homozygous embryos are starting to develop, but progressively through pregnancy, most of them are disappearing. So the calves that actually present with Brachyspina at birth are only a minor fraction of what was there. Many of them have dropped out by 56 days after insemination. There is a little bit of a rise in the ones where just the sire or just the dam was affected, and that could be due to the fact that there was one defect gene, or it could be due to genotyping. There are a number of things around, but basically many of those calves were dying in an embryo stage. So the question is, what impact would those kind of conditions have? Would we expect to find those kind of conditions? So just to show you, if we had the square box there representing a sire which was carrying a broken gene, which in a homozygous form resulted in a failure, and the cow was carrying the same defect, then we would expect, since half of the sperm are going to carry the broken gene and half of the egg, and they're independent, a quarter of the offspring would be affected, and 75% of them would have a normal pregnancy. But in real life, it's not going to be like that, because not 100% of the cows are going to be carrying that broken gene. So let's imagine, say, 10% of this mutation had spread through the population and become common enough that 10% of the cows could be infected. So those particular matings would only be in 10% of the total matings around. So in those particular matings, you would actually end up with only 2.5% of them being affected. So that's when you're mating a carrier bull to cows, 10% of whom are carriers and 90% of them are homozygous normal. So they would have 97.5% normal pregnancy. Now, if you mated those same kind of cows, 10% who are carriers, to perfectly normal bulls, then you would have no embryo lethality due to this particular problem. So if you look at the difference between the conception rate you would get from a single insemination when the bull was a carrier compared to when the bull was cleaned, the difference is only a 2.5% reduction in that single conception. And if these animals are, say, on pasture and they're in a multiple sire mating group, if she fails to conceive at this early embryo lethality, then of course she's just going to breed again in the next cycle. And it's highly likely she'll breed in the next cycle. So you could still end up with a very good reproductive rate, even though these things are occurring in your herd, with that mutation having as high a level as 10%. So it's going to be pretty hard to find these things, particularly if you've got a herd of only 10 or 20 or 30 or 50 cows, right? You're not going to see a reduction in conception rate of 2.5%. So embryo lethals, they require very high proportions of carriers before they can be detected, from reduced conception rate, increased failure rate, or more days to calving. You're not going to find them in small herds. You're not going to find them in herds that have many sires and have few offspring per sire, because you're just not going to feed them enough. So we find these things a lot more often, say, in sheep than we do in cattle, just because the reason that a normal ram would have more than 100 lambs every year in many sheep operations. Now, there's no chance of detecting these things in beef cattle without total herd reporting, right? We can't look at the database and find these things. We can't even look at the database and retrospectively determine if there was a problem like happened in the Netherlands. So one of the hypotheses is that perhaps there are many rare causes of embryo lethal. So I've just shown you at 10%, it only drops the conception rate by 2.5%. But what if there were lots, maybe there could be 10, 20, 30 different mutant things out there like that were each causing a small amount of lethality. Could that be a cause of reduced reproduction rate? Is that why you only get, say, 90% calving instead of 100% calving when you do everything else right? So we need some other ways to find these things. And one of the other ways, the first way I'll show you to find the phenotype first, when you see the strange mutant phenotype. The second way for looking at these things is what I call haplotype first, where we look for something called disequilibrium. And so that's another way where we inspect haplotype distributions and haplotype combinations. So here this is just a picture of the bovine genome. This is based on one of the first chips. This is before the 50K chip. A company called Affymetrix came out with a 10K SNP chip. The vertical bars represent the chromosomes. The horizontal bars represent the SNPs on that. And if we were to go to a particular position and just look in that little region, we could do a test to see, is it possible that that little region contains a lethal effect? And we could do this anywhere in the genome, but if we're sensible, we'll do this anywhere, everywhere. So we'll choose a little spot, we'll test it, and then we'll choose every other little spot, and we'll work our way through the whole genome. So that's exactly what has been done. In a typical region of 1% of the chromosome, so if we just take 1% of the chromosome on a 50K panel, there are about 20 SNP markers on average. They're labelled A, A, B, or B. When we send the data off to GeneSeq, when we get the data back, it tells us how many copies of the A and B allele they have. And we can convert that to a 0, 1, or 2, which is how many copies of the B allele. So for each animal tested, we end up with a string of 0, 1s, and 2s that has 50,000 numbers on it. And if we just look at a little piece of it, like 20 of those markers that are right next to each other, we get a little string of 0, 1s, and 2s. So that's the genotype. But the genotype is diploid. It's got two copies. It's got one copy of the allele that came from the sire and one copy of the allele that came from the dam. So if we knew the haplotypes, what we would be saying is what were the A and B alleles that are inherited from the father and what were the A and B alleles inherited from the mother. And just to show you in this example, whenever the animal has zero B alleles, we know that it didn't have a B allele from the mother and it didn't have a B allele from the father. So we can form the haplotypes by filling in a zero wherever the genotype is a zero. And whenever the genotype is a two, it said two Bs, it must have got one B from the father and one B from the mother, so we know both of the haplotypes have a B. So we can fill all those in. And the little underlined blue bits are the ones where we can't tell whether it's a zero or a one. We can't tell based on one animal. But if we have a population of data, we can actually work it out and fill those things in. And when we do that, that's called a haplotype. Now, if there were two loci, there are four possible haplotypes. There's the one with two A's, the one with one B, the one B in the second position, one B in the first position, or B's in both positions. With three loci, there's eight. With 20 loci, there's over a million possible haplotypes. So in that little wee percent, 1% of one chromosome, there's a million different combinations that are possible. But if the population is relatively small, if sires are used widely, we don't see anything like a million. And if we look at Hereford, say, if we look at any 1% piece, we find on average there's actually only about 20 different haplotypes present. And this shows you what they look like in three pieces that are just three different parts of the genome. I've looked at a 1% piece, and on average they've got 20 markers. The one on the left has got 11, the one in the middle 23, and the one on the right has got 28. And that just shows you the haplotype we saw among roughly 1,000 Hereford animals. So each animal's got two, so these counts are out of 2,000. So what you see for the first position on chromosome 7, that very first haplotype we saw over 1,000 times. So that's a very, very common haplotype in the population. The next haplotype in that chromosome 7 position we saw 250 times. So that means that 250 of the 2,000 haplotypes were of that particular kind. So that means that many of the bulls carry that haplotype and many of the cows carry that haplotype. So many of the matings that take place, however you choose to mate them, are going to involve matings between two animals that both carry that exact same haplotype. When we get further down the list, you see some of those haplotypes only occurred 10 or 20 times. So very few bulls carried it, very few cows carried it. So it would be very rare to have a mating between those animals. So we can't learn anything from those rare ones, but we can learn something from the common ones. And so if I just show you a little one there on the box on the right, if I take one of those haplotypes and I say, let's imagine that haplotype had a defect that I don't know about, and I've denoted it with a little red R, and if 20% of the sires carried that particular haplotype, and 20% of the dams carried that particular haplotype, then I would expect 4% of the matings to produce a calf that had two copies of that haplotype. And in 1,000 animals, that would be about 40 offspring. So if I go through the data and I find that particular combination 40 times, then I know there's no problem. But sampling can occur. So although I expect to see it 40 times, I might see it 60 times, I might see it 20 times, I might see it only 10 times. But if I see it, then I know that maybe that haplotype is okay. But if I never see it, then I would be very suspicious that there is a problem if I don't see that haplotype in homozygous form. So that has been done, and it was done several years ago in the US dairy industry. It was done in the Holsteins and the Jerseys. And when they did that, they found 5 regions that included a common haplotype that was never found to be homozygous. So this doesn't require reproductive data. It's only done from the 50K genotypes. The study was repeated in France. They did it in Holsteins, Montbéliards and Normandies, and they found CVM and Brachysphenus, so they found some of those old ones. They also found HH1 and HH3, which are two of the ones that Van Raden found here in the dairy cattle. And those ones, they now understand the causal mutation, and they have tests based on at least on those gene seq chips that test for those particular mutations.